Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 114 of the podcast, everybody. I'm Dan Prosser. Not with Andrew Frankel this week. He's taking a well-deserved break. He'll be back next week. So standing in for him, and what a super sub we've got. Henry Catchpole, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm delighted to be here. I shall attempt to do half as good a job as Andrew does. So.
So you'll all know Henry. He writes a piece a week for the Intercooler, and we're very pleased to have him writing a piece a week for us. He spent the best part of a century at Evo. He's now at Carfection, where they recently passed 1 million subscribers. So before we get started, congratulations, Henry. That really is quite a feat. Pleased with that?
Yes, yeah, very pleased. It's one of those things, I think because we tend not to follow the YouTube sort of way of doing things necessarily in terms of the films we put out, and we try not to sort of spoil things by asking people to like and subscribe at every second. So it feels all the more sort of special, I suppose, that we have actually reached that milestone. So yes, it's nice milestone to have reached.
Good, well done. So we're talking on the Monday after a weekend of motorsport. Le Mans and the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, excuse me, in Baku. So we'll discuss those. We're not going to hang around too long on those because they weren't necessarily fascinating, were they? But then we will come on to the form of motorsport that Henry's actually interested in. And we'll talk a little bit about him as well, his background in car journalism, what he's up to these days and so on. To get things underway then, 24 Hours of Le Mans, the 90th running. You had it on in the background all weekend, I understand, because your boy is obsessed with it. So this seems like almost free childcare for 24 hours, just plonking in front of the TV. So you were dipping in and out, weren't you?
It was quite a long 24 hours this year, wasn't it?
Yeah, if that makes sense, but I know what you mean. So a Toyota win, fifth in a row. Well done, Toyota. Congratulations. It's an achievement. They're yet to beat another major manufacturer at Le Mans. But they all count nonetheless.
They do all count, don't they? And as we saw sort of in other categories, anything can happen in the race. And you have to, as Toyota knows, only too well.
That's a good point.
You have to do all 24 hours. I was there that year and standing there waiting to sort of see the procession across the line and remember the consternation as the Toyota pulled up outside the pits with a lap to go. So yes, you do have to do the full race distance, and they did, but it wasn't the most exciting race from that perspective.
Yeah, and it's, you know, people often say that there are other categories and there's good racing in those, and it's true. But we want to see the fastest cars going at it, hammer and tongs, don't we, for 24 hours? And the reality is, the Toyota is just in a league of its own. Ahead of the only other hypercar entrant this time around, which is the Glickenhaus, and the Alpine, which is actually a grandfathered NMP1 car, isn't it? So, I mean, it was always Toyota's to lose. It never looked like Toyota was going to lose this one. And so, sadly, that just didn't make for the most gripping race at the front of the field. Do you know what, though? I'm really pleased, particularly for Brendan Hartley, who was one of the winners this time around. I remember watching him years ago, in the European Le Mans series, when he was driving for Murphy Prototypes, and he was visibly quicker than anybody else on track. He was a superstar back then. You could just tell that he was a sensational driver. After that, he had his torrid time in Formula One with Toro Rosso. He was unceremoniously dumped on the Red Bull young driver heap after, I think he did 20-something Grand Prix. So he didn't have much of a Formula One career to speak of. He's now a triple Le Mans winner.
Yeah. He had a good time at Porsche, didn't he?
Yeah.
At 919. So he did have time. And he was, like you say, in that car, he really was very quick and so visibly quick and occasionally sort of too quick for his own good in many respects and pushed that car harder than it wanted to be pushed. But yeah, as you say, it was really nice to see him take that. And actually that sort of links into one of the best things from the whole weekend, actually, was the hyperpole that they do for Le Mans now, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, sort of for a really nice snapshot of just how amazing those cars can look around Le Mans. Sort of really great look at the circuit as well. And there was I'm sure it would have riled Tiff Nadel, but sort of all sorts of tracks limits infringements, which was a bit irritating because it then sort of kept going, oh, you've got it, and it all seemed to be out of that last Ford chicane as well, so they could put in an entire lap. It was a bit like the 24 hours itself in miniature, because they could put in an entire lap and then just out of that last chicane over the edge, and that was it, time deleted. But it was a really, you know, Brendan put in a fantastic lap, as did Nick Tandy, who will probably come on to with a Corvette as well to take pole in GTE Pro.
Yeah, so we will come on to that. Brendan Hartley did set the pole time, and then he went on to win the race. So he's 32 years old. He's won it three times. I mean, if he chooses to, he could probably race on for another decade, maybe longer. We've seen drivers at Le Mans, even in the fastest cars, drive into their 40s. So, I mean, he could go on. If he finds himself in the right team over the next few years, he could win five or six or more, maybe. Although we know that we've got many more manufacturers on the way, and so hopefully that will bring depth of competition, and hopefully we won't see one team or one manufacturer dominating in years to come. Let's talk a little bit about Glickenhaus. They finished third behind the two Toyotas. Glickenhaus's first podium at Le Mans. Big achievement for a small outfit, although, again, there just isn't depth of competition at the moment. And so all they've done is beat the other Glickenhaus and the grandfathered Alpine. Nonetheless, as we've said, you have to get to the end. And they did. And I'm really pleased for Jim Glickenhaus, who we've spent some time with, huge petrol head, motorsport fanatic. I remember him spending several days in a rickety prefab building at Blyton Park for Evo Track Car of the Year. We were both there. And he was just very humble and quite happy to sit around for days on end and chat.
And I'm just pleased for him.
He's a proper car guy, isn't he? Yeah. And it's really nice to see that sort of story at Le Mans as well, I think. There have been so many of them down the years, and it's what makes Le Mans so fascinating, I think, is that sort of people, it does somehow seem, despite being this sort of absolute sort of upper echelon of motorsport, somehow more achievable for more people somehow, I think. Mm. Yes, he's obviously brought a huge amount of money into it, but it's as you say, fascinating cars, great to see them on the grid, livens the whole thing up, and it's a gives you a bit of an underdog to cheer for as well, and you never know what might happen. They stood on a podium at Le Mans, which is fantastic. And I think as well, it's one of those things we'll look back on in years to come, and you'll say, oh, you remember the Glickenhaus when they were sort of, oh, they were really cool, weren't they? And sort of they did get a podium, I think that's nice to have them there, and I hope they keep going.
So you referenced it earlier, maybe the big flashpoint of the 24 hours, the incident that took out the lead GTE Pro car, the Corvette. Nick Tandy, Alex Sims was in the car, wasn't he, and Tommy Miller. And it was the LMP2 car that jinked across on the Mulsanne into the front corner and wiped out the Corvette into the barrier. Out of the race, Francois Perraudeau was the driver of the LMP2 car. I don't know the chap, but he's got a presence on Instagram, and I've gone back and forth with him on Instagram.
Likewise,
I suspected you had as well. Seems like a good guy. It was a big old mistake. He owned up to it right away, and you could see on the live feed he went to go and apologised to the team, trailed by video, by television cameras. Not an easy thing to do, but he did it anyway.
Yeah, it was a horrible incident, wasn't it? Really, you could see exactly why it happened. You know, he is the AM part of that team. Obviously, he's a very experienced driver. I think he's competed about 10 times before, mostly in the GT category, which, you know, he's won a couple of WEC titles in GTE AM racing for AF Corsa, and it was a horrible thing. He was obviously being squeezed. He was the meat in the sandwich, wasn't he? And the other car was moving across, and I saw Tom Christensen talking about it afterwards, and he obviously laid the blame squarely at his door. But, you know, all he needed to do, as Tom said, was just be sort of more calmer, I suppose, with the steering input. He was being squeezed, but it didn't need the jink across. But having said that, you're in a race, you're accelerating hard in an MP2 car. You're low down, the view out, you suddenly see this thing out of the peripheral vision moving in. Instinct takes over, doesn't it? And I don't know whether he thought he was past the GT car, because again, say he was ahead of it, or alongside it, so, you know, view out, could he see it, blind spot, I don't know, but horrible to see that for the Corvette, because they were really running what looked like at that point to a fairly certain victory. They were quick, it looked like they were going to be reliable, despite the 63 car obviously had its problems. We're not quite sure why they happened, but that was a rear suspension failure, wasn't it? Horrible accident. I'm just glad that Alex walked away from that, apart from anything else.
So that's Le Mans. I mean, congratulations.
Probably lucky, actually, incidentally, that because that put the AF Corsa car in the GTE Pro category into the lead of that. So in some ways, it's probably quite good that the 91 Porsche won the GTE Pro category, because otherwise it would have kicked up even more fuss. I mean, not that it was done deliberately, there's absolutely no suggestion whatsoever, but it's not a great color for
quite right. So well done to all the class winners. The reality is, though, as far as Le Mans goes, we're just waiting for next year, aren't we? That's when it really gets interesting. That's when the hypercar era really kicks off, with other manufacturers joining. 12 months to wait. hopefully, if it's as good as it promises to be, we'll have this discussion again, but it'll fill a full hour. We'll see. Okay, let's do a little bit about Baku. And the big story is just Ferrari imploding in fairly catastrophic fashion. Again, actually. So it's the second time in three races that Leclerc has retired from the lead. And of course, in between that was Monaco, when his team, through a strategic blunder, threw away a Monaco Grand Prix win. And he's, so Leclerc has finished, has set pole the last four times, but just not been able to turn it into a race win. It's reliability that's absolutely hammering both Charles and Ferrari's title bid at the moment. It's frustrating to watch because at the start of the season, it looked as though we were in for another epic, this time between Verstappen and Leclerc. Now, do you know what? It's still early days. We're not yet into the second third of the season, I don't think. I am beginning to wonder, though, if actually what we're going to see from now on in is a Red Bull steamroller for the remainder of the season. Because that car in a race looks fearsomely quick. They had a couple of retirements early in the year, didn't they? But it's been pretty reliable since then. How do you think this one looks at the moment? Do you think Ferrari can pull it back?
As you say, there has been a huge swing from Red Bull or from Ferrari to Red Bulls. And you've got to hope that perhaps it can go back the other way as well. As you say, it seems pretty unlikely at the moment. It would be interesting to see if, I don't think it will happen, but it would be great to see a proper challenge from Perez in that second Red Bull, because he is clearly getting on with that car. You know, he's out-qualified Verstappen, well, certainly the last couple of Grand Prix, isn't he?
Yeah.
And it would just be, I don't think he's the favoured son there, but it would be great if he was right up there in the championship battle, and we could see a sort of internecine battle between the two of them, like we did with Lewis and Nico back in the day, at least. If Ferrari challenge isn't going to come off, because I genuinely, you know, and realise I'm standing in for Andrew Franklin. Like him, I've ever since being a young boy, adored Ferrari, and I, you know, nothing would make me happier than to see Ferrari win another F1 World Championship. So from a, you know, a biased view, yes, I really hope Ferrari does bring the fight back to them. I was reading something about how they have obviously sort of got to this point now where they are competing for championships, and sort of it seems like they're very much, I know you listen to the F1 Beyond the Grid podcast, and time and again when you listen to the engineers, particularly on that podcast, and they say how they had to try and build teams up over plenty of years, and obviously Ferrari did it, sort of had the, you know, years of pain before Michael Schumacher was winning you know, repetitively. And it's sort of, you know, again and again and again, teams just building up. Mercedes have obviously had the same thing. And it feels like Ferrari is getting there. They are sort of, we're all getting very hopeful about it, but the truth of the matter probably is that they're still building up, and it might only be sort of actually, you know, next year or even the year after that they really are. They've got that real foundation, that core of people that can make a car that will really, really challenge and win championships. I hope it's this year, but it might be that we've got overexcited.
I think you could be right. It might be a year too early for them. They've built a very quick car. They've won races, but it might just take a year to build that reliability into the thing. Because, I mean, they were not competitive last year. And so, you know, maybe they need a season of competing at the front, winning a handful of races before they can really mount a title challenge. But as you say, it would be wonderful if it actually happened this year. Let's move on a little bit. Let's not get too bogged down in Formula One, because really you want to talk about the World Rally Championship, don't you? There wasn't a rally last weekend, but we're not going to let that stop us, because that is, if there's a form of motorsport that you love above all else, it's rallying, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yep. Without question. And it's been a good season so far in 2022. So we've got a runaway leader in the championship in Calle Rovanpera, who is just extraordinary. So he's, for those who don't know, he's a, this really young,
21.
He's the sort of, you know, the Max Verstappen, I suppose, of rallying, son of a famous rally driver as well. And he's been, you know, we know he's been on the ice lakes, since the age of six or whatever. So as Ozier said, he's, you know, he's not really that new. He's not really a rookie because he's been doing this all his life. So, but nonetheless, you know, Colin McRae is still the youngest world champion. And Calderon Pair at the moment looks like he is going to absolutely smash that record. And it's his, everybody talks about him being mature beyond his years. And he really is. He's just has that eerie calm about him of a Loeb or an Ogier when they were in their absolute pomp and just looked like they, or Tanak actually. Tanak sort of most recently when he had that season when he won the world championship and it just looked like nothing could faze him. He knew that he was faster than anybody else and he could drive around at sort of, you know, 95% and still beat all of them. And when he needed to, as Loeb would do, put in that absolutely monster time through a stage and just blow everyone else out of the water, sort of both on the timesheets and mentally, really. And I think that's what he's doing at the moment, which is incredible to see.
So he won three in a row on different surfaces, which is a key point. Actually,
and also sweeping the gravel on the gravel event. I mean, there were slightly sort of mitigating circumstances because there had been a little bit of rain. Sort of, you could say there were reasons for it, but nonetheless, to win from the front is a very difficult thing to do in modern rallying. You have to spend the first day. If you're leading the championship, you open the roads on each stage. And on a gravel rally, that means you're sweeping the loose stones off the top of the surface. And yes, other cars obviously go through the stage before the rally cars, but only the WRC cars will take the lines that they are going to take and therefore sweep the road, as they say. So you are slower and the stage will get quicker as you go down the field. So you have to survive that first day in a reasonable position, and then it gets easier. But yeah, it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, very. And for one so young, in a matter of weeks to win on snow, on tarmac and gravel, it is extraordinary. It demonstrates that he's the real deal, the complete package. Do you remember, maybe, what we're talking, 15, 20 years ago or something, there were specialists and it was a huge deal for anyone other than a tarmac specialist to win on tarmac or a snow specialist to win on snow. But they're all so good these days that the best guys can win anywhere.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know who it was really that kind of, I don't know who it was that actually sort of ushered in the new era of the ultimate sort of all-rounder. It probably was Loeb, wasn't it? Yeah, the sort of the years of Gilles Panizzi, being brought in for the tarmac stages and having enough time at the end to do donuts on them, hairpins and things like that. I once met him actually up on, I know this is a sidetrack, but we were doing a group test, in fact, with cheap hire cars down in the south of France. And we were near the Col de Chirigny. And I remember, so we were somewhere where you hear this bang, bang. Oh. You thought, oh, I know what that is. And we drove up there and the Skoda Motorsport team, they were developing the S2000 Skoda Fabia. And there was Gilles Panizzi in old Peugeot overalls with the sort of the badges covered up and stuff like that. He's just really cool sort of outsider in an easy up. And then they disappeared off up there with sort of the lights blazing in the dusk and stuff like that. And it was, anyway, that was my Gilles Panizzi story. But
fantastic. But there you go. That's why rallying is so exciting, isn't it?
Go out and find an F1 team, sort of happen to find an F1 team testing, would you say?
No, it's so accessible. I mean, Rovan Pera, he's a Finn, and it looks as though, okay, there's a long way to go this year, but it does look as though he's going to do what Mikko Hirvonen and Jari-Matti Latvala didn't manage to do, which is win a championship. Those guys, at times, were phenomenally quick, particularly Latvala, but they never managed quite to string together a season. And it would be fantastic if Cali was able to do that this year. As I say, long way to go. But my God, the way he won those three in a row, it suggests he's going to pull it off, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. He's sort of, he was quick last year. We saw sort of flashes of that, but it feels like he's learnt, he's absorbed everything and come back with renewed confidence. Well, actually, I say renewed confidence. The curious thing is that in Monte Carlo, on the first stage of this year, what has happened looked totally unlikely because he was completely off the pace. He was nowhere and really struggling with the car. And it looked as though this dream of the prodigious talent wasn't a reality. And yet he sort of slowly turned it around through that rally, worked out how to drive the car, got comfortable with it, and has been pretty much sort of unbeatable since then. But it was quite the turnaround from that opening stage in Monte. But everyone was focused on, obviously, the two Sebs at the front of that rally.
And it was an epic one, wasn't it? It was a fantastic rally. Loeb eventually won. So Rovan Perra now leads the championship. Almost twice as many points as Neuville in second, 120 to 65. Now, the big frustration here for British rally fans is that twice Elfyn Evans, Welshman, Toyota driver, has finished second behind Sebastien Ogier, who retired at the end of last season. And so, obviously, you think, well, here we go. It's Elfyn's time. And yet, Cali Rovan Perra emerges, and Elfyn's actually had a fairly torrid season.
Yeah, poor Elfyn. He didn't just finish second to Sebastien Ogier either. I think that's kind of the thing. He really did push Ogier the last couple of years. You know, he took it right down to the last round on both occasions. And, you know, arguably he was leading into the last round going to Monza in 2020, wasn't it? It seemed like his year, but it just hasn't been. And that's rallying, really. Yes, he's made some mistakes. The one in the last rally, you know, he went through a compression, took a cut, and it just hold his sump, bust the water system. That was it. It feels like all his reliability, his sort of measured approach that has served him so well over the last couple of years, for some reason, something is just not right off. And it could just be the rallying gods looking down on him and saying, you know, this is not going to be your year, which sounds sort of horribly subjective and sort of, you know, I know people say that you make your own luck and all that, but there is a certain amount of luck in rallying. I think it's fair to say, sort of, particularly when they're travelling so fast, which they are in these cars, and with new technology in there as well, they're all getting used to it. So, coming back to Thierry Neuville as well, in terms of luck, I mean, he seems to, you know, have no luck at all. He's battling a Hyundai, which we know is behind on development. And Tanak proved last time out that it can win. Although I think everybody was looking at the long Saturday stage on that, which was extremely rough in Sardinia, and sort of just hoping against hope that it would get through. And the last two stages got cancelled, in fact, which I think was a massive blessing for Tanak and Hyundai. But Thierry Neuville has been sort of almost a standout performer in terms of just sheer grit. He and his co-driver, Martin Vardiga, pushing the car to get to the time control during one run, I think it was in Croatia, and just collapsing on the ground, absolutely exhausted to get this car. And it feels like they have been dragging it around the rallies, which is extraordinary to watch. And I'd love it if he's another one that obviously finished second to Sebastien Ogier for so many years. And it feels like he's probably another one that has thought, this is my year now. This is it. It's my chance. And it's not looking that way at the moment. So, yeah, rather, as with Le Mans, we need Hyundai to step up a bit more, I think, and take the fight to Toyota, which it looks like they might be doing. And Ford and Craig Breen.
Yeah, Breen, exactly. Yeah, well, let's hope so. Let's hope for a little bit more competition. It's fantastic to see Rovan Perra doing so well. But let's hope the likes of Evans, Neuville, Breen and others are able to mount a proper challenge at times this season.
And I think Craig Breen probably will as well. I think that's sort of, he's somebody that's always taken a little bit of time to get used to cars and sort of take those slow steps up, and then we know he's really, really super quick. I remember sitting next to him in an R2 Fiesta in a snowy, unseasonably snowy Greystoke Forest years ago when I was running a Fiesta ST long term, I think, and he was pretty young at the time, and all the marshals were just saying, "Who is this guy? He's just absolutely incredible." And I sat next to him, and it was one of the rides I shall never forget, because he just seemed to find grip where there really shouldn't be in this this little front-wheel drive Fiesta. So, yeah, he's definitely got the talent, and he's a proper rally nerd as well. He's a bit like Latvala in that extent. So I think you can't help but really like him, because he goes rallying all over the place. He's got a fantastic collection of old rally cars, and there's video footage of him driving Metro 6R4. I think up over Mole's Gap or something in Ireland, and it's fantastic to see that. So I hope he has the confidence now. He finished second on the last rally, and the Fiesta certainly looks like it's a fantastic package. Loads obviously proved that it can win. So good rest of the season in store, I hope.
Let's hope so. Do you know what, you're right about Breen being a proper rally nerd. I remember a good decade ago, maybe a bit longer, I went to Myra to have a drive in an E30 M3 rally car that ProDrive had just rebuilt. And I took my mate with me, Adam, who at the time was a very promising young rally driver, a contemporary of Breen's. And I took him along with me to have a proper go in the car, because I knew he'd be able to tell me more about it than I could. When we got there, ProDrive was there with another car, a Group N Subaru Impreza, which Breen was there to test. And the moment he clocked the E30 M3, he just dropped what he was doing, came over and had a look at it, and was just so jealous of Adam for getting to have a go in this cool car while he was driving a modern Group N thing. So from that moment on, I thought, yeah, this guy, he really gets it. He really loves it. So you're right. It'd be brilliant to see him winning rallies. We'll see. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Henry. Now, I suspect you've talked about how you got into car journalism and your time at Evo on other podcasts, so we won't delay ourselves with that here. More recently, you've been working for Carfection. You do bits and pieces elsewhere, including at Evo and in Bicycle Mags and as well as us. But I guess the most visible stuff you do is at Carfection, where you've been for several years now producing standout films.
It's very kind of you.
I really mean it. You must really love doing that, because you do it so well. You have a really good following behind you now. You just look like you're having the best time.
It's so different. I still think it's so curious, because I've said it before, but it's not what I got into motoring journalism to do. I got into it to do features in magazines. And I think the good thing is that I always loved the visual side of that. I always loved the fact that magazines are sort of the paper versions of video, because you want the words and the pictures to all work together. And I loved working with the fantastic photographers that I've worked with over the years. And so the video stuff kind of help. I get more input, I suppose, into the visuals and sort of coming up with the ideas and things that we can do. So I love that side of it, I think, as much as the sort of, I don't know, I love crafting the videos, I suppose. That's what's sort of, you know, it's a pain to do. I'm not going to lie. I was talking to somebody about it the other day, but it now almost feels like a holiday to go and do a magazine feature. Yeah. Just because of the way that you create them, you still work hard, but it's a different sort of process that you go through to make them. And obviously you get the time to think about things after the event a bit more when you write them, whereas you have to be rather more agile, certainly on launches and things like that.
Yeah.
In terms of thinking about what the car's like. And thankfully I have the experience now and I trust myself to make those decisions in the moment and say things to camera that I won't regret later. But I do. I really enjoy the end product of the video making, and it does make me feel proud. And you get all the feedback straight away as well, which, as you know, from the putting that on the internet, which is both good and bad. And it always makes me really pretty nervous, I have to say, when we put a big film out. And but it's very satisfying at the same time. And it's satisfying, I think, the amount that you can now do and achieve with the equipment, which has come on so much since I started working with Sam Riley at Evo back in the day, producing the videos for them. And we've just seen the equipment that we can get hold of for, yes, it's expensive, but not sort of, it's not in the realms of sort of television costs. And yet you can produce some phenomenal looking results and images with the drones. Obviously it's a massive thing, but also just the image quality of the other cameras and things. It's really fun to be able to do that and I think produce some fun stuff.
Yeah. You're very good at getting into the comments beneath your videos and responding to people. I mean, it's probably different for you now because it's all very positive for you, as far as I can tell, because you are actually at the top of your game. But that's something that all of us who put content out there regularly struggle with, is that instant feedback. And I mean, you will have had it in the past where people are just aggressively rude. And probably it hurts because you know that on some level they're actually right. I certainly feel that way. You know, when I started, I can do it now. I'm not brilliant at it, but I can do it. But I remember when I just started, like we all were, I was hopeless. And the thing about this game is that there isn't the time or the resource to learn your craft in private before you start putting stuff out there. So the very first time I spoke to a camera, that went out on YouTube to 500,000 people. It's still there. You can find it if you want to. Please don't. But it's horrendous. And of course, you know, you get hammering it for it in the comments. And I'm perhaps not secure enough, or I don't have enough of a hide to just brush that off. It actually does affect me, and I think it does a lot of other people. It
certainly affects me. And as you say, it's the it's particularly anything when I think integrity is called into question, because yeah. You know, I would hate it to think, you know, is you know, we're journalists at the end of the day, and I pride myself in trying to give a, you know, an honest opinion of cars. I think I sometimes probably get accused of being too lenient, being excited about everything, which I think is I am a glass half full sort of person. And as we've sort of, I know Andrew Hetz's phrase, there are no bad cars, and I'm with him on that. There certainly are bad traits and bad things in cars, but fundamentally as well, there's a view that you know, not every car is going to be to my personal taste, but I'm well aware that it will be to a lot of people's taste out there. And part of my job is to see, you know, to not be subjective in terms of bashing a car I don't particularly like, but actually seeing why other people might like it, whilst remaining balanced. And also, you know, I'm not, you know, this is not brain surgery. I'm not doing it. It's fundamentally, I'm doing something that is fun and it is enjoyable. And I tend to enjoy what I do. I don't want to try and be too negative about things unless it's sort of, you know, unless it's required, because, it's there are a lot of other things to worry about in the world. It's sort of, I enjoy cars and I enjoy driving all sorts of things. I think that's the truth of it. Yeah. But yeah, it does hurt when people say horrible things, particularly when I think it's undeserved, but there we go.
It does go with the territory. There we go. And we're lucky enough to get to do this stuff, so, you know, a little bit of flack from a few people, we can live with it, can't we?
You learn over the years as well. I think it's one of the things I saw fairly quickly, as you say, you put something out there, and I was probably lucky enough that it was things were going out to not a huge audience in the early days, and you quickly work out when somebody says something sort of particularly, if it's something I can change or I have control over, then I'll try and make sure that that's, you know, something I do every time. So the way I look, I can't really change great. I used to not sort of, I don't, yeah, I don't spend as much time clearly as you on your hair, doing my hair in the morning. But I have learned over the years that just taking a, you know, the moment to look in the mirror before you go on camera probably helps a bit, even though people probably don't think I do. There's a horrible video out there somewhere of a Citroen DS3R, which I think hopefully is pretty hard to find these days. But my word, I was clearly going through a dark time in my life, because the combination of the beard and the massive hair, and I clearly didn't look in the mirror when I got dressed in the morning either. So after that, I thought, yeah, you need to just take a bit of time, because otherwise, if people are commenting on that,
yeah,
it's distracting from what you're trying to achieve in terms of, I want people looking at the car. I don't yeah, because I want people looking at me. So I don't want to be a distraction, if that makes sense.
Okay, so I think it's quite easy to forget that between Evo and Carfection, there was something else, Drive Tribe, and perhaps because it is fairly short-lived. Now, we were at Evo together before you left, and prior to that, Jethro Bovingdon had been poached to go over and work with Clarkson, Hammond and May at Drive Tribe from Evo. And then I remember you taking me outside the office and saying, I'm off, going to Drive Tribe. And I thought, oh my God, everyone's going apart from me. And we just sort of sat back and watched while this enormous thing came into being, and it seemed to have so much money behind it. And they were poaching all the top talent, and it looked like you had all the cash to go off to Europe and hire racetracks and take time over films. It just didn't last very long. What are your memories of Drive Tribe?
It's a mixed bag. I think, as you say, it didn't last very long. I talked to Jethro about it occasionally, and, you know, we both agree we did some really cool stuff there, and we got to make some good films, which I think still stack up. And it gave us a bit more freedom to do that. It was obviously interesting working with Clarkson, Hammond and May. Not that I spent that much time with them. Interesting working as a startup, interesting working in London, because it was something I hadn't really done before. It was unfortunate. I think those early months, a lot changed very quickly. The sort of the vision for what it was going to be probably changed a lot, which is understandable. But then I have to be probably, I don't know how careful I have to be about what I say. But anyway, somebody came on board in terms of recruiting, and there was all sorts of sort of power vacuums and things like that. And they had a different vision for what this thing was going to be. And very much, I think, sort of the clickbait side of things was their thing, which is an easy way. The whole point of it is the easy way to get numbers and boost it. And in terms of the more considered editorial content that Jethro and I were doing, and Ben Pullman was doing a fantastic job on the production side, Sam doing the videos, James Goff, all that sort of thing. But it just, we looked like, I think to him, he wasn't a car person, and we looked like a very expensive way of creating content that, you know, a video shot on a mobile phone of 2 seconds could potentially get as many views. And as much as we might say, but it's about, you know, what we're doing is more than that, and plenty of other people did get it. You know, it was just this one person that didn't, and say he took the first opportunity to get rid of all of us at one fell swoop. Oof. And I was on a launch, actually. I was on a Lamborghini Performante launch out in Italy, and I got a phone call to say and we're making you redundant. So I hadn't driven the car, so I had to say, do you want me to drive the car? I did. I made a video because it's sort of it was obviously the professional thing to do, and I wanted to. But yeah, that was the end of that.
Well, there you go. I mean, it didn't last long, but on to bigger and better things. And one of the things you've done recently, actually for Evo, was drive the Lotus Emira. You did a long road trip into Europe, into some of your favourite roads, down towards Monaco. And since then, all the reviews have come out on that car. Lots of videos, lots of written articles. How do we phrase this? It wasn't unanimously praised and adored, was it? I mean, Andrew gave it an 8 out of 10, which is a good rating, a really, really bloody good rating, but he had his reservations.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there'll be probably by the time this podcast goes out, actually, I'm just waiting for the final edit of the Car Affection film to come in. And it's a... I fundamentally agree with what Andrew said on all those points. I think there's we all had huge hopes for this car, and it is still, you know, it does still deliver at times. It's got some lovely steering, and on the right bit of road for it, it's a great thing to drive. I think there's in tighter stuff, sort of the front end certainly doesn't give the sort of the feedback that I would hope for and expect. I know Andrew sort of felt the understeer on track, and yeah, you can still feel it sort of on the road and sort of tighter corners and things like that. So yeah, I think we need to try other variants of it as well, and we need to try the full production cars as well, because that was the frustrating thing. And again, Andrew mentioned it, but all the cars that we drove were pre-production cars. And so it meant that we couldn't really comment on, you know, the final NVH, the build quality, things like that, which are really, really important for this Emira. So, yeah, it feels like there's more to come, because there are, again, things like the, I know he mentioned the optional limb slip diff on it, but the change in tyres that you get. So if you put the Cup 2 tyres on the sport chassis, then you also get geometry changes with that as well, in terms of toe at the front, and camber on the roof. So that, you know, that can make a massive difference to how it will feel. So yeah, it feels like there's more of the story to tell with that car yet. And I think the new drivetrain as well, which that I think that AMG drivetrain with the DCT gearbox will, it won't mean it feels so tied to previous Lotuses, and again we'll make it feel like quite a different car. So yeah, it's certainly not all bad, but I think perhaps people were expecting, well, I think we were expecting, and obviously the everyone else was expecting it to be unanimously sort of received in with praise and trumpets from heaven and all that sort of thing. So yeah, no.
That's right. There's much more to discover about that car, isn't there? We will continue reporting about it. Okay. Well, to end this podcast, I've asked for some questions for you on Instagram, and I've got a whole load of them here. We'll just run through a couple. Before we do that, I just want to say thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. If you're looking to buy a new or used car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. You'll find contact details in the caption below. Please also rate and review the podcast. That's really important. Tell your friends and subscribe, follow wherever you listen to or watch the podcast. That really helps. So listen to questions. The first one is from our young writer, Hamir Thapar. I'd love to know his favourite era of rallying, as well as which driver he idolised most.
Ooh. Wow, that is a really difficult one. I mean, obviously, I own a Mark II Escort, and I think there is something sort of kind of almost slightly sort of heroic about that era. But I suppose I'm a huge Ari Vatanen fan as well. I was lucky enough to meet him, so that feeds into that. And I think the sort of, yeah, it probably is that era, I think, that sort of has inspired me, obviously, to buy the Escort, and there's something about Vatanen and the way he drove and the sort of sense of adventure, the sort of the almost sort of Corinthian spirit of rallying back then, which I think still exists a lot more now, but probably gets hidden behind a lot of the media. Yeah, I don't know, I'll probably regret that. I'm a massive Loeb fan as well. Yeah, but we'll go for that.
Good answer. Thin Ring 09. This is an interesting one because our line of work has changed so much in the 15 years or so that we've been doing it. What advice would you give to someone trying to become an automotive journalist?
Well, I would say, so actually it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of you saying that, you know, the first video you did was went out to, you know, 500,000 people or whatever like that, and you instantly feel rabbit in the headlights. I've always said that whether it's writing you want to get into or now obviously the video side of things, practice. So write things. You know, you don't have to show them to anybody at all. But just the mere fact that you've written it will gets you on that road. Similarly, talk to a camera. Again, you don't have to publish it. There's nobody, you don't have to do these things live. And it's that practice that will, you'll instantly spot mistakes that you're making, and then be able to correct them and go back and do it again. And you have the ability to do that time and again. If you're going to write, I'd say try writing columns. The sort of length that goes up on the intercooler, or even shorter than that, is nice. Give yourself a word limit, because otherwise it's very easy to just keep going on and on, and then it makes it difficult to edit. Similarly with the films, you know, if you have a smartphone, then you have pretty much all the tools you need to be able to practice and actually make a film these days, which is incredible. So that, and also watch and read, but do so critically. So find out what you like, not to necessarily emulate, but just it'll all feed into it, but make sure you do so. Don't just absorb it, you know, really be critical. Obviously not of my stuff.
No.
Yeah, that's really good advice, though. I absolutely agree with everything you've said. We've had a few questions about your Clio 182. Do you still have it? Is it, what sort of state is it in? Is it fun?
It needs an MOT at the moment. Poor thing. I do say it's there, but for various circumstances, it's been parked up away from the house at the moment in storage. So yes, I still own it. It's there. I love it a bit. It hasn't seen many miles in the last couple of months. So I need to go and dig the thing out. Between that and the Escort that hasn't currently got an engine in it, I'm not doing terribly well, but yes.
Okay, final one then, just to wrap things up. This is from Dogs and Donuts. I'm going to paraphrase the question a little bit, actually, because we know you love cars. We know you love cycling. You do a lot of work for cycling magazines. You compete as well on your road bike, don't you? Have you ever wondered about combining those? Because are you aware there is a type of machine that has both two wheels like a bicycle and an engine like a car? Any interest?
Well, actually, one of the things I thought we might have talked about this week was the TT, which is obviously just finished as well. And Peter Hickman obviously won four races, and there's some extraordinary photos I've seen of that. And so, as you can tell, I love motorbikes. I love the whole sort of, you know, particularly road racing, which I suppose is the sort of the motorcycle kind of rallying, some extent. I think it's fabulous, and the Isle of Man is one of my favourite places. I have never ridden a motorbike, and it was something that people will probably scoff, but I promised my dear mother many years ago that I wouldn't. And I think it's probably a very good decision. I sort of, at the time, I was, the last time of asking, I think I was driving around in Caterhams and I was competing in the British Rally Championship. So I actually thought, do you know what? I'm getting enough thrills from my cars that I don't need to go and learn to ride a motorbike. And I think that, as much as I like to kid myself that I could just commute on something and just enjoy, I don't know, a Ducati Monster or something like that on a sort of a very recreational basis and use it as enjoyable transport that wouldn't necessarily get stuck in traffic jams, I know that's not the case. And I would want a motorbike, and I'd want to go to track days, and I'd want to try and ride it quickly. And therefore, I would fall off at some point, because I think it is inevitable. At that point, you are in the lap of the gods as to whether you injure yourself or worse. you know, I know it's not the, you know, you don't have to go and ride the TT where there were, you know, sadly another, I think, 5 deaths this year, but it is dangerous. So yes, I love motorbikes. Mm. I totally get them. I really do understand why people love them, and part of me would love to do it, but I have enough else going on that it's something I can live without.
Yeah, it actually mirrors how I feel about them. Well, there we go. Thank you, everybody, for getting your questions for Henry in. And Henry, thank you so much for standing in for Andrew. Really appreciate your time.
Not at all. Normal service resumed next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.